for the security of our relationship, it's not that important. For our ability to take care of each other, it is important, but I think this is more important than us.
Two couples talk about why they're challenging the state's gay marriage ban. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, East High graduates talk about attending one of the most diverse high schools in the country.
I mean, everyone sits together. It's not just Polynesians on one side and Dominicans on one side. It's mixed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Five gay couples are behind the lawsuit challenging Alaska's ban on same-sex marriage. The suit was filed Monday in federal court, and in this case, the political is especially personal. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has the story.
Courtney Lamb is in the early stages of planning her wedding.
I've asked people to be like, you know, bridesmaids, and I have my veil and my shoes.
She has ideas for a dress, too. For a location, she thinks Girdwood would be nice. And when it comes to the reception, Lamb wants it to be more fun than traditional.
You know, like, I want a cupcake tower, not like a big eight-tier cake. And
there's just one big wrinkle. Lamb doesn't know if the state will allow her to marry her fiancé by their wedding date. She and her partner, Stephanie Pearson, are one of five gay couples fighting an Alaska ban on same-sex marriage. Since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the federal government must recognize gay marriages, judges all across the country have decided state-level bans are unconstitutional. On Wednesday, Idaho's ban was struck down. The same thing happened last week in Arkansas. Oklahoma, Virginia, Illinois, Michigan, and Texas have all seen similar decisions from federal courts this year. Lamb thinks there's a good shot that gay marriage could be legal in Alaska and even nationwide by next May.
We're, you know, planning our wedding, and if this goes through and it's legal by the time we have all of our plans finalized, then that's wonderful. And if not, then we will have a big party with our friends and still celebrate ourselves and our relationship.
Fellow plaintiffs Matthew Hamby and Christopher Sheldon are on the opposite side of the spectrum. They've already been married twice. The first time was in 2008 in Canada, where same-sex marriage has been legal for nearly a decade. Sheldon remembers it fondly.
We were married outdoors, and that time of year, it was raining a lot, so we took a lot of umbrellas with us.
They read their vows again this Christmas Eve, this time in Utah. A judge had ruled against the state's marriage ban that week, and the couple was already there visiting family. Hamby says they took advantage of the moment.
Of course, when you fill out the license, you have to state that you're not married. And so, of course, I said, well, we are married. We've been married since 2006 in Canada. And she says, well, as long as you're marrying the same person, it's okay.
Sheldon says that's when they realized the possibility for Alaska.
I think that if we saw that, if Utah could see that change, that Alaska's constitutional amendment was probably unconstitutional too before the United States Constitution, and it really did give us hope.
Hamby and Sheldon have been a couple for nearly a decade, and they've lived in Alaska for longer than that. Sheldon moved here in 1994. Hamby came up in 1997, right before the state's voters adopted the first gay marriage ban in the country.
I thought it was almost devastating. It seemed like I was moving to a place that was creating a second tier of status for gay people.
Yeah, you feel like, you know, do you even want to stay? But we love Alaska, and we don't really have any desire to be anywhere else, and yet we don't feel like we're protected. We don't feel like we have the same rights as other people. We don't feel like we can take each care of each other properly.
It's more than just a social stigma, they say. For example, they wanted to get a specific title on their house for legal purposes, but they can't because their marriage is not recognized. Hamby says there's just a greater burden placed on them when dealing with state government.
Straight couples just have to check a box and put a name and social security number on there and say they're married.
Gay couples have to provide an affidavit and have a handful of legal documents like vehicle registrations and wills ready to go to prove they're together. Sheldon says if their legal challenge is successful, that would be a thing of the past. And he thinks having legal recognition matters for the gay community, especially its younger members.
For the security of our relationship, it's not that important. For our ability to take care of each other, it is important, but I think this is more important than us.
The state is expected to defend the marriage ban in court. Opinion in Alaska has recently been shifting toward gay marriage. According to a survey released by Public Policy Polling on Wednesday, 52% of Alaskans favor gay marriage, while 43% oppose it. Last year, the numbers were essentially flipped. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A vessel transiting the Nooshagak River apparently hit something overnight that punctured a fuel tank. An estimated 2,000 gallons of diesel leaked from the vessel, KDLG's Mike Mason reports.
Petty Officer Sean Eggert is a spokesman for Coast Guard Sector Anchorage. He says the incident happened around 1 a.m. Wednesday morning.
Sector Anchorage Command Center received a report from the charter vessel Devon. The ship's master reported that he had struck a rock in the Nooshagak River and that he was losing fuel. He reported as being diesel fuel, and at this time we have an estimate of about 2,000 gallons that went into the water. He was about 10 miles east of Dillingham when it happened. And there weren't any injuries, just damage to the vessel.
The fuel spill was very concerning to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game because of the level of subsistence fishing activity in the lower stretch of the Nooshagak River. Tim Sands is the area management biologist for the Division of Commercial Fisheries. He flew the river Wednesday afternoon. He says the location of the fuel spill was about halfway between Dillingham and Lewis Point.
We saw some places that we believe there was potentially some sheen, but there was no rainbow sheen, just like slick water places, and things that looked kind of suspicious, but couldn't definitively say it was a sheen or not.
Initially, ADF&G advised subsistence fishermen to take the precautionary move of removing gear from the water downriver of the fuel spill. However, Tim Sands says that may not be necessary.
It's probably not as essential to pull your running lines and things like that. I guess if it were me, I'd be real cautious. I wouldn't want to ruin my net, so I'd make sure it didn't smell anything or didn't look like there's anything in the water if I put my net out, or maybe even just skip a day or two and let things settle out here.
The fuel spill prompted a response from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and the Coast Guard. Responders with both organizations flew into Dillingham Wednesday and apparently inspected the landing craft Devon and interviewed the crew. Petty Officer Eggert confirms that sheening was observed in the Nooshagak River by the crew of a Coast Guard C-130 that did an overflight Wednesday morning. However, it appears the diesel fuel has since dissipated and could not be seen as a sheen Wednesday afternoon. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a pilot recounts the moment he fell in love with Alaska.
We headed back out to our campsite, passing a sign that said aircraft have the right of way on roads. I turned to Ann and I said, "We're in the right place."
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack and stroke, miscarriage and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Seniors from most of Anchorage's high schools are graduating this week and next. The district's high schools rank among the most diverse in the nation. East East High tops that list with more than 2,000 kids from every corner of the world. KSKA's Ann Hillman spoke with grads about how all that diversity affected their education.
Inside Sullivan Arena, students are lined up to receive their diplomas. Outside, a few tables are set up with a selection of classic graduation presents, like flowers and teddy bears. But the Lays are clearly the most popular. Pepe Aqui sits at a booth surrounded by candy strung together and leaves woven into necklaces. She says giving a graduate Lays is a way to show love and honor. It's a way of life.
And if we are able to do that here in, you know, because there's like so much different nationalities and, you know, with the mixtures of different people sharing their cultures, I think it's a way of making the world a better place to live.
Graduate Nicole Child arrived at East from private school and says the transition opened her eyes.
I've learned to accept more cultures, actually. Like, I don't know, I guess from my family background, I kind of believe more what they said, but as I met like the other kids and their cultures, it wasn't bad.
Valerie Thau says she took time during high school to learn about other cultures, and fellow students asked her about her Hmong culture too. But she admits her circle of friends is probably less diverse.
They're Hmong, but they're mostly they're Hmong, but I also have a couple friends that are other culture too.
Friday Thor is with her friend who just graduated. She finished up at Bartlett 2 years ago. She and her friend agree that in their experiences, diversity didn't always equate to integration. Thor says people often hung out together because they connected through language, like her native Nuer.
Us, we speak another language. Like, I'd be more comfortable going to my people and hanging out with my people that speak my language rather than hanging out with people who speak English. And I feel like African-Americans and, you know, Caucasian kids mix around because they don't have that comfort group that they're with, you know?
UAA sociology professor Chad Farrell says diversity doesn't necessarily lead to cross-cultural friendships. Farrell is the one who ran the numbers for Anchorage. He used Department of Education data to see how the city's schools compared to others in the nation. Just like many Anchorage neighborhoods, they're all significantly more diverse than average. But East, Bartlett, and West take the top spots. So what does that really mean?
Another way to think about it is that your average Anchorage resident has more localized diversity surrounding him or her than your average American. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that people are hanging out or striking up friendships with their neighbors who are from a different ethno-racial group, but it certainly speaks to the exposure to localized diversity is higher here than you see in other metropolitan areas.
After the graduation ceremony wraps up, Presley Piliassi emerged from the arena. His face peeks out from a mound of Lays made of Cheetos, candy bars, and small pink flowers. He's surrounded by family and friends.
Why are you wearing so many Lays? What does it all mean?
Tradition. It's a tradition.
Your family, I love you.
My family showing me love and all that.
Piliassi says at East, the students from different backgrounds do hang out with each other.
Everyone hangs out with each other. The ethnicity, I mean, everyone sits together. It's not just Polynesians on one side and Dominicans on one side. It's mixed. So we mix it up and we just make friends with each other.
And share their Lays, which hang around hundreds of graduates' necks. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Community Development Quota, or CDQ, groups are supposed to harness some of the wealth from Western Alaska's booming fisheries. They all invest in education by handing out scholarships to coastal residents. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, one CDQ group is changing the way it invests in graduate students to get the returns it wants.
Larry Cotter is the director of the Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association. He says that a PICTA scholarship program was pretty simple. Students from the Aleutians and Pribilofs could get up to $5,000 every year to pay for school. That works well for undergraduates.
First and foremost, I think the goal is to encourage folks to get an education.
and set the table for their future.
But it's different for students who pursue an advanced degree, like a master's or a doctorate. In the past 5 years, about 15 graduate students have gotten grants from APICTA to put towards school. There's no data on how many of them have returned to the Aleutians and Pribilofs afterwards, but Cotter says the region needs all of those students to put their graduate degrees to work in their communities, and APICTA wasn't doing enough to draw them back home.
And the way to do that would be to shift away from providing an outright scholarship to encouraging the students to go get student loans, and then we would pay those student loans off at up to $5,000 a year if they returned to the region and worked, or worked for somebody working with the region.
That could be a government agency like the Aleutians East Borough, or it could be a nonprofit group, or even APICTA itself. Cotter says this is new to APICTA, but they're not the only ones using loan repayments to hold on to highly educated residents. The CDQ group for the Bristol Bay region, the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, will pay off up to $20,000 in graduate school loans for students from the area if they come back home to work for at least 1 year. The Bristol Bay group didn't respond to a request for information about that program, but according to their annual reports, they've been offering loan forgiveness to graduate students for at least a decade, and Cotter says that inspired APICTA.
Frankly, I think we may have looked at their program and said, you know, that makes sense.
In the Aleutians and Pribilofs, the changes are already going into effect. Residents who came back to work for the region after school will have until July 1st to apply for student loan repayments from APICTA. After that, more rounds of funding will follow. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
It's been a year since Unalaska started uncovering big problems with a major construction project in town. Work is moving forward on the city's wastewater treatment plant, but as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, the city is still trying to put a price on the damage done.
Workers at the wastewater treatment plant site are busy pouring concrete for the building's water tanks and foundations. City Manager Chris Laddick says they'll be able to start building the actual structure of the plant in the next month.
You know, they had planned on being further along than they are, but I don't think it's going to impact the total schedule.
The plant has to be online by the end of 2015, as mandated by a settlement with the Environmental Protection Agency. Meanwhile, Laddick says they're working on another issue, one that was never supposed to be a part of the project. They're trying to add up the cost of issues with blasting work done at the site last year. Advanced Blasting was originally hired to carve out a hole for the wastewater treatment plant's foundations, but the city says they blasted too deep and too wide and left behind explosive materials, including sticks of dynamite. And contractors on the project say it's cost them at least $1.6 million and counting to deal with the issues. In some cases, the city's agreed to pay what they're asking. They granted a $340,000 change order to Alaska Mechanical, the lead contractor at the wastewater plant, to fill in the overblasted area. But Northern Mechanical, the subcontractor at the plant, is asking for a lot more, $1.3 million to be exact. Laddick says the company did face a lot of extra work. They had to deal with the overblasting and the abandoned explosives at the site.
It was completed last July and August, I believe, the work. You know, they would find a blasting material and then they'd stop work and have to deal with it. So there's a lot of starts and stops.
Northern Mechanical hasn't been paid for that extra work yet because the city wants more details on why it costs so much.
We're saying, wow, that's a lot of money. Okay, show us your backup. Show us your time card. Show us how many trucks you used, all that kind of stuff. That's well within our rights to do that.
Either way, it's not just financial cost from blasting issues that's adding up at the wastewater plant. It's costing time, too. Laddick says Alaska Mechanical wants to add extra days on the end of their contract to make up for the delays. He says that shouldn't be a problem. The city built a buffer into their construction schedule so they could meet the EPA's deadline even if they ran into problems. But all those problems have had a ripple effect, and it's spread to another municipal project, the landfill expansion. Dynamite wrappers turned up in piles of rock there last month, bringing work to a halt. The contaminated rock had come from the wastewater treatment plant, and Northern Alaska, the contractor that was supposed to use the rock to expand the landfill, needed to clean it up. Laddick says they asked for $2.3 million extra to do it.
That was just to go through 40,000 yards of rock, and they were going to go through it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure there wasn't anything in it.
The city thought that was too expensive, so they canceled the contract altogether. The project will go back out to bid in the next week or so. Whoever picks it up will also have to deal with the contaminated rocks. That'll all make up the total price of the blasting issues at the wastewater plant. Once the city approves the contractor's requests and tallies the final cost, Laddock says they'll bring it to advanced blasting and start looking at getting paid back.
Yeah, we're going to sit down with them and talk about it, that's for sure.
That conversation won't involve lawyers, at least not at first. But with projects worth more than $23 million total and several companies' reputations at stake, Laddock says it's a definite possibility down the road. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Advanced Blasting says the company won't comment on the city of Unalaska's allegations.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Finding the time for physical activity after school, homework, and dinner can be tough, but you can make it a priority to stay healthy as a family. Go for a bike ride, take a walk around the neighborhood, or play a game of basketball with your kids. Get active, get moving, and have fun as a family. Inspire your kids to get out and play 60 minutes every day. For more ways to get physically active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Copper River commercial fishing season kicks off tomorrow morning. KCHU's Tony Gorman reports.
Last year's Copper River commercial fishing season got off to a slow start due to a late spring.
Well, last year we had ice conditions that persisted really late into the spring, and we weren't able to launch the sonar at the usual time.
Amanda Weiss is an Alaska Department of Fish and Game Assistant Area Management Biologist for Prince William Sound. She says those conditions also prohibited salmon passage.
Even when we did launch the sonar, we didn't see any counts for quite a while, so that caused a later salmon run, but then it peaked pretty quickly.
According to Fish and Game, the total commercial harvest in 2013 was 96.2 million fish, with 2.4 million being sockeyes, the most coveted of the run. Weiss says this season's start is opposite from last year.
We have very low water conditions on the Copper River right now and a very warm spring. And the sonar is in the water earlier than usual. It's already up and running full counts since yesterday. And usually it doesn't start running until May 15th.
As of Monday, 440 fish passed through the sonar, with 140 being salmon. This season's projected harvest is 1.6 million for Copper River sockeyes, 22,000 for kings, and 280,000 for pinks. The first opening for the Copper River commercial fishing season is Thursday morning for 12 hours. It is for gillnet fishing. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Alaska is celebrating a century of aviation. As part of an occasional series on Alaska aviators, we're gathering stories of flying. Chuck Cesara came to Alaska in 1955 after graduating from UCLA. He and his wife, Anne, drove the Alaska Highway in a VW bus. He got a job the very day they got to Anchorage with Pacific Northern Airlines.
I went running out of the building, across the gravel parking lot, yelling at my wife, "Guess what? I got a job. Start tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. So we jumped in my Volkswagen bus, and we headed back out to our campsite at Eagle River, passing a sign that said, "Aircraft have the right of way on roads." I turned to Ann and I said, "We're in the right place. I'm staying here."
And stay they did. Cesara became a state legislator, serving in the House from 1964 to 1970. He also flew a lot, logging 27,000 hours. He says the stories that stick with him are about people, like a nun he met at St. Mary's Mission School when he was flying there weekly. She had immigrated alone from Italy as a young woman, making her way from New York to Seattle.
Got Alaska steam in Seattle and went to Nome, then an open longboat in Nome across Norton Sound and up the Yukon River to St. Mary's Mission, not knowing a one word of English. And she had been there 60 years, working daily, every day. I was stunned. And then I said, as I was leaving that day, "Is there anything I can bring you? I'm going to Anchorage. I'll be back in a week." She said, "Yes, there is one thing." I said, "What's that?" She says, "I would like to be a U.S. citizen." I said, I turned to Mother Superior and I said, "What? Tell me about this." She says, "Well, she's applied a number of times, but it required her to go back to Seattle at first and then later to go to Anchorage. And you got to be in front of a U.S. district judge to do it. And it just got to be overwhelming. And as she got older, she wouldn't fly in an airplane, a little airplane. So I made up my mind to get her U.S. citizenship. So I came back to Anchorage. I called Mike Gravel in in Washington, D.C. I was a U.S. senator. I said, Mike, you got to do me a favor. I'm sending you the papers. I filled them out. I signed them for her. Put them in front of INS and tell them you're going to wait for them right there. Just execute them and hand them back to you. Mike called me the next day and said, Chuck, the paperwork's signed and it's on its way to you. And then I went to Ray Plummer, United States District Judge in Anchorage. I said, I want you to see, can you go with me to St. Mary's Mission? And oh, by the way, I have a second one now. She's from Germany. Her name is Scholastica. She's a newcomer. She's only been there 46 years. So we flew out there in an F-27 jet turboprop. And we flew out and landed there on the gravel runway at St. Mary's. And there was about 50 people waiting for us. And they had one old 6x6 truck, old Army truck. That's the only truck in the village. And they made the pilot, co-pilot, flight attendant, myself, and the clerk and the judge get up in the truck while this escort of about 50 people walked on each side of us. And we walked into the village about half a mile away. We got out and walked into the gymnasium. I was stunned. The gymnasium was packed wall to wall with Eskimos, all wearing their finest fur garments, there to see her do that. Most of them had grown up around the mission, but a lot of them had walked over 100 miles to get there, and we had the ceremony there. These two little nuns put their hands in the air and raised their hands and swore to defend the United States against all aggression, foreign or domestic. In other words, take up arms. There wasn't a dry eye in the place. They broke into song. They sang America the Beautiful. Date was Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1969. And when people say, what'd you ever do as a legislator? That's the first story I tell them.
Former state legislator and retired pilot Chuck Cesara. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal and Annie Ropeek in Onalaska, and Tony Gorman in Valdez. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, offering 3D mammography since January 2014, technology that helps their radiologists detect breast cancer. Learn more at provimaging.com.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.